Coming up, we have Corey Tulliba from No Ceilings talking about March Madness, and we're doing a 2025 NBA redraft as well. Later in the show, we have Cam and Caden Boozer from Duke. They're coming on to talk about what they get going on with March Madness coming up. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. We got a full draft show today. Selection Sunday was yesterday. We found out the full bracket. We're going to look at things through a full draft lens. From No Ceilings, Corey. How you doing, Corey?
Kevin, I am awesome. Beautiful rainy day here in New York City. But I'm excited to do this in person, man. We've done a couple, you know, virtually, but this is the first one we get to do face-to-face, so I'm excited.
I'm very excited. I do one in person with you here at Yahoo Studios here in New York City. Before we get to some draft stuff, a little bit of NBA news this morning. Sham Sharani reported that next week during the Board of Governors meetings, owners are finally going to vote on moving forward with expanding with Las Vegas and Seattle as the only two teams they would exclusively focus on for expansion to go from 30 teams to 32 teams with Memphis or Minnesota moving to the Eastern Conference. Initial thoughts, Corey, what do you think about this? Is the league ready to expand? Is it deep enough? What do you think?
I mean, this has been rumored for in some capacity for years with both locations. Obviously, Vegas has been something the NBA has been pushing for a while with, you know, Summer League has turned into what it's turned into, a massive event every year. You have the NBA Cup, obviously, that is been there and has done well. So we know that. And then Seattle, like, I mean, we've been clamoring for them to get a team back since the team left. So I think it's cool. I do think that we're at a point where there is so much talent. I mean, don't get me wrong. The counter argument is that tanking is already bad enough. Now you're going to bring in two more teams into the fold. But I think the game is evolving in a way that this is also, you have to look at it long term. And I think it's going to be cool. I mean, you know, it's not the only league with 32 teams.
For sure.
Right? So I think we'll figure it out.
NHL expanded to 32. NFL's at 32. It's a good number for professional sports teams in America. And I would just hope personally. So Strom said this would likely be to prepare for the 28-29 season. So a little bit of ways from now, but still before 2030, like a lot of people were seemingly anticipating. That's a bit sooner. I would hope that Adam Silver pushes for schedule changes that align with what happens with expansion. Because if you're expanding to 32, that creates opportunity for you to create a balanced schedule,
right?
Face everybody twice. All of the 31 teams, you face them twice. 62 game regular season you could have, and with play-in on top of that, with NBA Cup expanded on top of that. There's ways for them to go about that and overhauling the schedule to make it start to finish more interesting without these lulls that we kind of have. They kind of addressed it with the NBA Cup in November, December. They're trying, you know, I would expect to address it in the February, March, early April stage where it's playoff race, but like we're in a lull right now.
Right.
And I mean, a lot of people are starting to focus on college basketball. So I'm optimistic. I'm in favor of it. I think the league is deep enough. I'm hopeful that it happens. My understanding is that there is increasing support from owners behind it. Shams did say $7 to $10 billion each team could potentially go for. So that's a lot more revenue.
A lot of money.
And just from a personal standpoint, I hope Seattle gets a team. I want to go to a Sonics game in my life, you know?
It's an incredible city,
mm-hmm.
You know? Sonics game, go see Kurt Cobain's house.
Jimi Hendrix.
Yes.
I walked by Electric Lady Studios this morning in Cafe Wa, back where Jimmy used to play, the studio he opened. And there's like the Museum of Pop is in Seattle, formerly owned by Paul Allen, is a great Hendrix exhibit. I got to go. I want to go. I would go even if without a Sonics team. But
100%. That's Pacific Northwest is a great, section of this country, and like the Blazers do great there. We know that the Sonics have,
With Seattle coming back, eat into Portland's market,
maybe a little
possibly.
Bit, maybe a little bit.
Yeah,
but
hard to say.
You know, it's a storied, you know, franchise. You still see Sonics merch. You know, like there's still people who want this. So I think it'll be awesome for those fans to get their team back.
I think it was Gary Payton II said if the Seattle Sonics, Super Sonics, come back, he would want to go play there. He'd demand a trade to go to the Sonics. And I'm sure there'd be some players. Gary Payton II, you're demanding a trade?
Me too.
So we'll see what happens there. More on the NBA through a March Madness lens. Let's talk about key NBA draft storylines to watch in March Madness. Number one has to be the health of Darren Peterson.
Yeah.
A story in the Kansas City Star recently quoted Darren Peterson talking to reporters after a recent game where he opened up about how preseason during a training, not even basketball, just doing sprints, he got what he called a full body cramp that forced him to have to go to the hospital. And he received two IVs there. I had previously reported on my podcast, I think it might have been the episode with you, where I had heard that he had received IVs and done a bunch of blood work and changed diets and this and that and different workouts, to everything to try to address the cramping. And nothing has really worked. For Peterson to come out and reveal this, my first thought is, A, okay, well, we need to really learn more here, because if you're going to the hospital for something, it's something medical. And B, boy, like, his team has botched the messaging of this more than you could botch anything at all. I mean, how is he talking to the reporters about this openly? It just blows my mind. What was your initial thought when you saw that story, Corey?
Well, dating back to that episode that we had done together, you asked if I was worried at all. And I was like, no, I'm not worried at all. Like,
are you worried now?
I'm a little more worried now, especially hearing, like, you had to be hospitalized. And, like, I don't know what the long-term ramifications are of whatever it is that he's going through. Because even though he spoke on it, we still don't have clarity, right? Like, I'm sure NBA teams, when they get medicals, you know, over the next couple of months, you know, maybe there'll be more intel that comes out about what it could potentially mean long-term. But, yeah, I'm a little bit worried because he's still not the guy that we saw at Prolific Prep from an athletic standpoint. Mm-hmm. And, you know, back when we spoke a couple of months ago, it was like, all right, well, I expect him by this time, if he's still playing, to look closer to himself. And don't get me wrong, he's still been really good. And he's had moments where he's been great, even. But he's not getting all the way to the rim. It seems like anytime there's like a slight bit of daylight, right, he's almost getting the shot up. And then just play style wise, play type wise, you know, one of the things we wanted to see was his playmaking and getting other guys involved. And there has been flashes here and there. And this was one of my concerns with him actually going to Kansas, because I don't think that program is really like a kingsmaker of like true NBA level star talent, at least from the guard positions, that he wouldn't get to show as much of that. So it was like I had that concern before the season. But we really have not seen it. He had his negative assist to turnover ratio, you know, in conference play. So there are some concerns about, like, those lofty Kobe comparisons. I think I brought up that maybe he's playing more like Ray Allen, and that's what he looks like. But even Ray Allen, when he was young, was an athletic freak.
He's a dunker. He could put it on you.
You know, like, so he was Jesus Shuttlesworth. Like, he did it all. So I am a little bit worried. So I have moved him one spot down my board.
Where is he now?
Now he's at two, and
behind Boozer or DiBonsa?
Behind Boozer, okay. But that two through four.
Jesus, what does DiBonsa have to do? God.
He has, since the time we spoke with him too, he's also taken his game up to a completely new level as well. It's the ever so slightest margins.
You're holding on to what Peterson was in high school.
Yeah.
Which is totally fair. He was unbelievable. Elite shooter, elite on ball, elite off ball, could get to the rim. He looked more dynamic.
Defensively
was, you know, impactful. Two-way. The fact is, like, today, on March 16th, as we record this, he does not look as athletic as he did 3 months ago.
No.
At the early part of the season. And 3 months ago, he didn't look as athletic as he did a year ago at this time at Prolific Prep. And that's where I look at things and I'm like, what's going on here?
If I were ranking them based on this season only, I'd probably have him after DiBonsa and Caleb Wilson.
I think that's totally fair.
And you make an argument for Darius Acuff, too.
I would agree. But
that's the tricky part of the draft. Yes. You don't want to over-index that and then look back.
Is this just a blip?
Was he just dealing with something that was, you know, only going to affect him this year? And that's where, this is why intel is important.
Well, and like, it's... The intel, like I said in February too, when we did our podcast then, the intel was what I said. He had received IVs, he's done blood work, he's changed his diet, he's changed his workout regimen, they've done this, they've done that, they've tried everything, he's gone to different doctors, and nobody has come with an actual diagnosis. This is really the most strong piece of information that we've had, that he actually went to the hospital over this, because WNBA player Kelsey Mitchell went to the hospital last year for something quite similar. She had cramps and they said that she has rhabdomyolysis.
Sure.
Which is, I probably butchered the pronunciation. If you're a doctor, feel free to correct me. But that is the breakdown of muscle tissue that leads to the release of muscle fiber contents into the blood. That is not necessarily something that you can have multiple times over. It's like, say, something that happens as a byproduct of something else, from my understanding. So was that a one-off with that happening last year with him having to go to the hospital? Has this happened multiple times? Is this why he's pulling himself out of games? Because they want to avoid that happening, pushing himself too far. Why is he now playing 30 plus minutes per game, but also playing the worst he has all season? His shooting numbers are down. He's not getting to the rim as often. He's less impactful defensively. He's made some good plays, don't get me wrong. Yeah. But he's playing the worst stretch of his entire year at Kansas while playing the most minutes. There's just like a lot of questions right now with him.
Right now, with the way he's playing, his impact is partially relying on the ball going in the hoop. Whereas you want a guy who is going to potentially be all NBA superstar type player to have an impact everywhere.
Yes.
And, that's not to say teams still respect him. They still think he's a threat, whether the ball's going in or not. It's going to help elevate his teammates and make things easier from that perspective. And defensively, he's still doing some of the things that we thought he would do. But yeah, the rest of his game is becoming a little bit more questionable. It's up in the air. And partially, one of the things that scares me about fading him too much too is he does seem like an insular, motivated guy too, who might use this as a chip on his shoulder of being everybody doubted me.
All the intel is that he is a hard worker. He does have a desire to be a really good NBA player.
Now, is he a psychopath who's going to, the Draymond, the Kobe's?
Where I don't think so. I'm not so sure. There's some contrasting info there that I'll sit on for a later date, but I'm not so sure there. The fact is that from a Kansas perspective, they're in a position right now where you'd hope they have a shot to make a run. We'll see there. With Darren Peterson, though, Kansas is better with Peterson off the floor. They have a better offensive rating, a better defensive rating, a better net rating, a better free throw rate, a better assist percentage. And so Kansas is 3 points per 100 possessions better, worse with Darren Peterson on the floor. That's a big outlier when you look at other top draft prospects. BYU is 15.8 points better with AJ DiBonsa. Duke is 13 better with Cam Boozer. UNC was 9.7 better with Caleb Wilson. So Peterson, then being having a 3.0 net rating worse with Peterson on the floor is an outlier amount. What do you make of that when it comes to evaluating Peterson from the draft, the fact that Kansas is better without him statistically and with the eye test? Sometimes it just looks like the offense flows a lot better without him.
Dating myself back to one of my favorite TV shows of Lost, it's almost like it's a little man of science versus man of faith right now with Peterson, where Kansas it seems like they've become accustomed to playing without him. And it almost feels like he's still trying to fit in when he is playing with them. Part of it, though, is what's weird is he's the guy almost that it feels like has to sacrifice his game. Because I don't know what it would look like as much if Melvin Council was sacrificing his game. Is he as effective? So in the backcourt in particular, it seems easier for him to play in positions where he's uncomfortable. But the fact that, the team is better with him off and the other guys, they're so much better with them on, it is a little concerning. And you have to come back to just having the faith that this is not the real version of Darren Peterson that we're getting. This is not the guy that was, propped up as the next big thing. It's really a faith-based argument in some respects.
Last seven games, so since he pulled himself out of the game against Oklahoma State, beats me. Last seven games, he's played 32, 30, 31, 34, 29, 37, and 28 minutes. So this is the longest stretch of his career playing the most minutes. He is shooting 27% from three, 42% from two-point range, averaging only 19 points per game, getting to the free throw line still. Assist to turnover ratio, 2.1 assists to 1.4 turnovers. Not his best stretch shooting the ball. Is that because of the cramps? Is that because he's pushing through it? We will find out more, I'm sure, this month in March. We'll see how long Kansas goes. And then we'll find out definitely more during the pre-draft period, April, May, and June. And with Peterson, he still is in the top three on most people's boards. There's a chance he shifts down depending on the medical. But one guy that is out the remainder of the season is Caleb Wilson. So second key NBA draft storyline to watch during March Madness, there is no Caleb Wilson for North Carolina. The fourth player on most boards right now. Could someone move ahead of Caleb Wilson? Is there a prospect that comes to mind to you, Corey, that has a chance to move into that fourth slot ahead of Wilson with his absence?
The NBA draft is chaotic. there's always a chance, you know, because all it takes is one team. At the end of the day, all the boards, you know, all the consensus, you're going to have surprise picks. And with high-end talent, the teams are going to go with who they believe. So
team need, philosophy, so many variables we don't know without the order.
So is there a chance? I would say yes. At the same time, like, there's also a chance that I see Caleb Wilson being the second pick, the third pick. So, like, I think that he can go either way. Clearly, being out for March Madness, a lot of narrative shape during this time. But for NBA teams, too, it's not just this year that they're evaluating. They're evaluating these kids in high school. So I don't think there's going to be too sharp of an overreaction. But if there are two, I think there are two guys that have a chance still to play their way into that conversation. The first guy is Darius Acuff. He's maybe the hottest player in college basketball right
Dude's
now.
Dude's amazing.
He's doing whatever you want, I guess, except play, you know, defense.
He's a little bit of Ole on that end. But it's kind of forgiving when you see the fact that he's carrying the offense, playing 37, 38, 39 minutes, sometimes every minute, hit 30 points in their tournament win on Sunday, 24 the night before, 37 the night before that. Mm-hmm. So in three nights in a row, 37 points, 24 points, 30 points, not breaking a sweat.
The other thing that he's doing outside of distributing the ball, just from a scoring perspective, because he's, you know, I think probably the best passer in this class.
Yes.
The most creative, the most deliberate, the most cerebral, manipulative. But the other thing that he's done, which, you know, there have been people who are wondering about his full-on scoring process, you know, can he shoot more threes? And then his free throw rate is kind of mediocre. He's gotten to the line 8.5 times per game over his last 10. And I don't know, 4 or 5 games have been at least 10 plus free throws. So he's doing a better job. And I still think that there's room for even improvement there. It's almost like he's not as strong as Derrick Rose was or as explosive, right? But he is strong and athletic. And sometimes it almost feels like he can maybe not get some calls just because he's not going to move as much when he does get bumped. There's a little bit of that. But then there's also opportunity where
he's got a football player frame.
Yeah. But then there's also opportunity where he's going to learn to do the Jalen Brunson, SGA, whatever foul grift as he continues to develop. Mm-hmm. And, oh, I got like a slight step. I'm going to dip my shoulder just ever so slightly, create a little bit of contact, and now I'm going to get the call. So, like, there's still levels for him to go up, and he's playing at such a high level already. And then defensively, yes, there's a little Ole, but he doesn't have, like, you know, like you said, he's like built like a football player. It's not like this is a sub-6-foot guard, you know, who can't.
He's not Tyler Tanner. That small.
Right. You know, who's obviously great in the passing lanes.
Absolutely.
And like makes an impact.
High impact in that way. Yes. But he's small,
but
straight up small.
You can target him in a way that with Acuff you can't, because he's strong, he's long, you know, he has the tools there at least to do it. It's about want. But I think Acuff is the guy just because he's so dynamic offensively. And even if he's not going to be your number one option on a championship team, because it's so hard for guards to do that, he can still be the number two, the number three, if your team's really lucky.
And the reason why that's important is because of his ability to play off ball.
Right.
When I had Rashad Phillips on last week, of course, he's the uncle. He's very biased of Darius Acuff. But like, I think everything he said in the podcast, I agree with from an unbiased perspective. His ability to play on ball and off ball is such an asset. So if he doesn't become a number one, if he becomes a number two or a number three, he's made almost 50% of his catch and shoot threes this year. He has an ability to move off ball. With that sturdy body, that football player frame, you could have him set an on-ball screen for a bigger guy.
This is the Tyrese Maxey.
Yes.
Cal had Tyrese Maxey, and Ashton Higgins was running the show there. So a lot of what we saw with Maxey in college was
great callback,
running off screens and all. And what's cool about Acuff is, like, typically guards who are on ball a lot, they don't have the crafty little ways that they're going to flare, you know, and run off screens. And he's kind of got it.
Yes.
So I have full faith that he's going to be comfortable playing off other guys. And then the other guy I think has a chance, and he was the guy that I think most people have in either the 4 or 5 spot in the preseason, and he's been in and out of the lineups with injury. But when the highs are high, Michael Brown Jr.
Oh, I was wondering where you were going to go. Yeah, I like
when
it.
When the highs are high,
like
and we know that March Madness, you know, it's only a few games, and if a guard gets hot, they can propel a run in a real way. So if he just has like a 4-game stretch where he hits 25 threes or whatever, and he's done that already this season. And, you know, I like Conwell. Like, they have guys who can play. He could be a guy who can regain the steam that I think he's kind of lost at various points of the year.
It's been a very strange year for Mykal Brown, because you see his 45-point breakout and you're like, oh my God, he's here. He's back. Louisville's got South Florida in the first round, and then they'll face either, if they advance, Michigan State or North Dakota State. I think there's a chance we see them in the Sweet 16.
There's a chance.
There's a real chance of that. And if they do get there, it's going to be in part of Mykal Brown. With him, his last 11 games since he returned from his injury that hampered him earlier in the year, his makes per game: 7, 1, 7, 1, 2, 14, 8, 11, 5, 9, 2.
Yeah.
Up and down. You don't know what you're going to get every single night. When he's on, the dude is unstoppable. Yep. There's nothing you can do about him with his pull-up, his ability to get to the rim and finish with his right hand, his left hand off
punch
foot.
On people.
Oh, my God. He can dunk on people. He can rifle passes across the court with either hand as well. There's some real elite talent when you see him on the highs. But then you see the 1-for-7s and the 2-for-10s, and you're like, oh, geez.
It's like, is he going to look like Dame tonight, or is he going to look like Anthony Simons?
Yes, exactly. 100% the truth. And that's where, with Louisville, if you get the best version of Mykal Brown, you get a chance to make a deep run in March Madness. If you don't, well, I mean, he's the type of guy you look at and you're like, I like him, I don't love him as a prospect. But I agree with those two. I think those are two higher upside guys. I wouldn't necessarily say the same about, I don't know, like, I don't think Nate Amendt's going to be in that conversation. A Phylon, I don't see any of those names.
Not that high.
Maybe a Keaton Wagler, Kingston Flemings, I could see. Yeah. Some of these guards, I think the guards are the ones we're really talking about here. Mykal Brown, Acuff, Flemings, Wagler, and that's in part because of what need is going to be in that third or fourth slot. So I think we got a good list there. On the other side, upperclassmen. Are there going to be some upperclassmen you could see either solidify their stock or improve their stock entering or exiting March Madness after this month?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Michigan's got two dudes, you know, in Yaxel Lindeborg and Ade Mara, who, you know, if they put Michigan on an extended
tough run for Michigan, tough bracket,
tough one, but that'll make it ever more the opportunity to solidify their stock. But we always see like an upperclassman guard, I feel like, who has like this crazy run. We saw it with Walter Clayton last year. Like, I'm wondering if Bennett Sturts can be a guy who I think NBA teams are probably going to be a little bit more skeptical than like the public scouting space is on Sturts as like a lottery level guy.
What's the difference there between NBA teams, just to give some context to the listeners?
I think that, I mean, the private side is they're looking at his efficiency. The fact that he never comes off the floor, he doesn't turn the ball over, he's managed to sustain basically his efficiency going from Drake to Iowa. But he's a guy who basically always has the ball. Even when he doesn't, you know, he's not capable of making a move the first time and beating his guy off the bounce, he's able to pull it out and reset it and get a second chance at that. And it's like, are you going to take the ball out of the hands of, you know, name your all-star level guard at the next level? Or so it's like his play style, and I think he's suited to play on or off the ball, but like the way that he thrives and that he has thrived over his college career is by just doing everything and being an engine. And I think the questions are going to be like, is this an engine worthy player from NBA teams? And also they're a little skeptical of just older guys to begin with, especially when they are guards. So I think that's where the disconnect is between the two sides. But I also think that if he's able to put Iowa on some magical run, that there is a chance that a lot of that skepticism dwindles, because he can shoot the crap out of the ball.
He can.
And he's a really like heady, smart player. So, you know, if he leads them on some run, then maybe teams look at it like, all right, we know he might be able to have like a Peyton Pritchard type impact. But is there more? And should we take him in that tail end of the lottery?
Well, I think the people who are skeptical of him will look at that Iowa State game earlier in the year where he was a 3-for-11, was not a good performance for him. Michigan State as well, and Michigan 7-for-23 as well. He's had some clunkers.
Yeah.
And if Iowa beats Clemson in the first round, strong chance it'll be Florida, the defending national champions, in the second round.
And Clemson's no cakewalk either.
No, it is not. So I think for Iowa, to your point, if we do see Iowa get through Clemson and then beat Florida and get to the Sweet 16, that's where that conversation is really going to help out a guy like Bennett Sturts for sure. Freshmen. Which freshman will end up positioned to go back to school after March Madness?
There are two that come to mind. Nate Ament, I think, could be from Tennessee, could be one of the guys. The other guy I would mention is Braylon Mullins from UConn. Conversely, I could see, you know, two other guys who were highly touted coming in. You can look at their priors and just say, hey, we're one and dones. And
yeah,
wherever we get drafted, we get drafted. Because I think ultimately, like, you know, Ament has not lived up to the lofty top five play that he was projected to have this year. But he is still 6'10 and has all of these skills. And, you know, you look at some of the advanced stats and you can make his case that maybe he doesn't go four, but you could take him 15.
He should go back, Corey.
Yeah, I just saw.
Amen should go back.
I flew to Nashville and I watched him against Vanderbilt a couple of weeks ago. And it's funny, one of my buddies lives in Nashville. He's a songwriter. He does not know ball. You know, it may be 90s ball because of, you know, trading cards, but he doesn't know ball. And we're on the court watching him warm up. And, you know, Ament, like, was trying to do, like, a dribble move, and he just, like, the ball went out of bounds.
Really?
And he tried to do it again.
During warm-ups?
During warm-ups. And he tried to do it again, and it, like, went out of bounds again. And my buddy's like, that guy?
Wow. And, you're here to watch him?
And it was, and I was like, that guy. you know, and, like, he had a beautiful opening drive, and then he disappeared until, I don't know, halfway through the second half, and he turned it on halfway through the second half.
That's the Ament experience.
So, yeah. And part of me wonders, though, because I think there would be a lot of teams who are like, he should go back. He should improve. There, you know, he's going to be a guy that whatever year he decided to come out is going to be a pro. You know, like, he just, at the end of the day, he's 6'9", 6'10", whatever, and he has all of these tools.
Not just the scorer. Right. He's got some playmaking feel. He can pass a little bit of shot creation potential.
Potential.
I mean, we'll see over time, but I think, like, with the scoring ability, doesn't really get to the rim. When he does get to the rim, he's not a good finisher.
No.
45% at the rim this year, according to Synergy.
He's almost trying to get fouled when he gets there instead of finishing and then getting fouled.
Exactly. And so, like, that 45% number is since his mid-year breakout. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, it was only 55% at the rim. He's made 41% of his mid-range pull-ups, only 31% of his threes off the dribble, small sample size. You'd like that number to get a little bit higher up over time, which it could.
The mid-range pull-ups, though, like, one, those shots are reserved for
mega stars.
Scores.
Yes,
but part of the reason he has to settle for those shots is because he doesn't have the burst to get all the way to the rim, and he just realizes, okay, I'm 6'10", so I'm going to turn my back, and they're like these mid-range like fadeaways that they turn into, and he's obviously got touch there, and he's skilled at knocking those down, but he can't like dip his shoulder and establish position and get closer to the hoop. So he's not there yet physically, even though he has gotten a lot stronger since high school, to his credit. So that's the thing. It's like this dichotomy of like there's a lot to like there. And if you were buying in on tools, you can make the case. But, you know, there's a lot that people are just feeling like blah about. And that's where if he was to come back, get better over an offseason, have a year of college basketball under his belt, he could really break out in a weaker class.
He could be number one next year.
In a weaker class.
He could be number one next year if he comes back and has a big year as a sophomore. I don't think you could rule that out. I think the reason why I'm still like, I know he had like six straight games where he looked pretty good, 24 points per game. So much of that was fueled by the fact he just shot catch and shoot threes well. It's not like he was generating shots at the dribble at a higher level or anything. Since that quote-unquote breakout, he's made 42% of his catch and shoot threes. First 18 games, though, only 24%. So didn't shoot well early in the year. He shot well on catch and shoot opportunities lately, but still not better at the rim, still not better getting to the rim, still shaky from mid-range efficiency-wise. There's just too much for him to improve on, unless Tennessee goes on a run.
And teams have maybe a sour taste in their mouth from guys like Salon, Richache, you know, even Bouzelas, who's been the best, I think, of that grouping.
Yes,
you know,
for sure.
And he just had a 40-point game, right? Like, he's flashed a lot.
Against the tanking Warriors, of course.
but even, you know, Bouzelas is not lighting the world on fire necessarily. So that, like, archetype, maybe there's, like, something where teams are like, are we overvaluing just the fact that he's tall? You know,
I think so. Honestly, yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think that, but like, we'll see with the skill level how it develops. Did you say you had one more other than Ament?
Braylon Mullins from UConn.
Oh, yeah, Braylon Mullins. That's right. Yeah, yeah. Mullins is a good one.
And
34.5% from three. I think you'd like to see him shoot better.
You know, it's like 14.5 threes per 100 possessions. So he's getting them up. I just thought that in that UConn system, based on what I had seen from like the AAU tape, because there's not, you know, he was a public school, like not much to take from that. His stats were outrageous there. I just thought he was going to be able to feast off the ball as like a cutter. And especially because he's athletic, like he had 20 dunks in AAU. This is not your typical like all I do is shoot guy. Not that he's like a creative guy like Khan. Like, you know, I think that was like the early comp to him because Khan was having success because he didn't have that handle. But like there was a little bit more to his game that he hasn't necessarily shown that I thought he might show, you know, because he was almost like a combination of like Cam Spencer and Jordan Hawkins. And like, you know, I just thought there was a little bit more there offensively. Now he missed the early part of the year with an ankle injury. So, you know, maybe just acclimating to it all, you know, caused him to maybe just, hey, I got to fit into this specific role now. But I thought we'd see some more athletic indicators. I mean, he never gets to the free throw line, like ever. And that's a concern, you know, like, especially because I thought, you know, there was some physicality to him before the college season. So I think that if he comes out, he's just, you know, he's going to be probably around 6'5". He's got pretty good, like, defensive numbers. So he's not just like a one-way shooter, which I think the league has kind of phased out. And he's young. But if he went back another year and showed other aspects of his game, again, instead of like, oh, is he going to be like in the 15 to 20 range or 15 to 25 range? Because, you know, we just saw McNeely go where, you know, and who's taller.
Yeah, and, late 20s.
Yeah. He can come back again, like Ament, and be like, okay, I'm going to be a top seven pick.
Which he should. And without Caravan there next year, there could conceivably be more opportunities to be in different spaces as we've seen Caravan occupy over the years at UConn, with him being more than just a spot-up shooter like he was when he was super young. Fifth question here, fifth storyline on my mind entering March Madness from a draft perspective. Does BYU give AJ DiBonsa the keys? Because I'm watching that BYU-Houston game, and last 5 minutes of the game, DiBonsa shot only four times. Rob Wright dominated the ball. There's a two-minute stretch where DiBonsa didn't even get a touch. And I'm like screaming at my TV like, Kevin Young, did you see DiBonsa creating off the dribble in the first half against pressure, this cross-court whip pass bullseye to Rob Wright from the right wing DiBonsa to the left wing Rob Wright, bullseye pass for an open spot up three. Did you not see this guy put the ball in his hands and let him create against this elite defense in Houston? And then I watched Duke, and Boozer did not have his best game. But what did they do? They put the ball in Boozer's hands over and over and over and over down the stretch. Every single possession, he got a touch. And that comes from the coaching staff.
Sure.
And so I'm wondering, you know, BYU's missing guys. They have injuries. Will they empower their freshman, their best player, the potential number one pick, and AJ DiBonsa, and let him guide them to victory? Live and die with AJ DiBonsa, because that game against Houston, to me, was not encouraging for BYU's chances of going far.
A little like a year one LeBron Wade, like your turn, my turn.
Get out of the way, Rob Wright.
Yeah,
Obviously,
Rob Wright is not D. Wade in this scenario, right?
He's Mario Chalmers. Get out of the way.
I hope so. I don't know if we'll see it. It's, you know, we're so deep into the season, you would have thought, especially after losing Richie Saunders, hey, let's just give AJ the keys, put him on ball. I posted an 8-minute video the other day of DiBonsa's playmaking, because I feel like people just label him a scorer, you know, and like he really is a good passer. Now, I think where the weakness is in that is
how long was your Peterson passing video? 90 seconds?
That one didn't get posted.
20 seconds?
Yeah, it didn't get posted.
Still editing it. Still looking for clips.
Yeah, I'm still, we'll get there.
And yet you still have him ahead of DiBonsa. Okay. All right. Come join me. Come to Brockton represent. Maybe I'm the biased one. Me and AJ both being from Brockton.
I posted the Peterson defense video in his place. We're waiting on AJ still.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Totally fair there. I'll bet on 6'9", long arm, tough guy to figure it out defensively.
I don't want to come off like I'm too skeptical on AJ, because I love AJ's game and he is going to be an all NBA level player. I just think there might be like four or five potentially in this class.
Of course,
so it's hard.
Totally fair.
But I hope
beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Right? That's what this year's draft class is.
Absolutely. And, you know, AJ still has to figure out like, okay, I have so much gravity with my scoring that I can manipulate the defense every time down the floor. And I think that'll open up some of even easier scoring opportunities for him if he like is able to consistently become a playmaker and a scorer. But he's fully capable of it. And maybe if it was like, hey, you are our point guard, maybe that unlocks it to where, because he's empowered to play maybe a different role than, you know, he's been playing, where it's like, all right, he's still getting these reps and these opportunities. But like a lot of the time, like it's not him bringing the ball up the court. He's like coming off some action and then like flowing into a ball screen. And maybe it was just like, we're going to spread out. We have an athletic dude who's going to set screens. He's been awesome throwing lobs, like the touch, the timing. It would be awesome to see if he did get the opportunity to just be almost in the role that Cooper Flagg was in for the Mavericks earlier this year.
I thought Kevin Young ran a pro offense. I thought that's what was promised. So beats me that this guy who supposedly comes from the NBA and runs a pro offense doesn't know give your best player the ball. Just give it to him. Not Rob Wright, not Mario Chalmers. Blows my mind. And we'll see.
Mario Chalmers hit the shot.
He did. But Rob Wright, like, you can hit the shot too, but it should be coming from DiBonsa. Yeah. Maybe it's a hockey assist. Maybe it's a direct assist. But DiBonsa got to have the ball in his hands the last 4 minutes of that game. Every possession against Houston, they probably win that game if they don't go away from DiBonsa, in my opinion. And we'll be right back after this break. Yahoo Fantasy Bracket Mayhem brackets are now open for your chance to win $50,000. Go fill out the men's and women's bracket. You can win $25,000 apiece. And those, visit yahoofantasy.com/bracketmayhem to fill out your brackets today. We're going to talk about opening weekend prospect matchups. I want to start out with BYU potentially versus Texas.
Yeah.
We might see DiBonsa versus Swain. Two potential lottery picks, definitely a top five pick in DiBonsa. Yeah. Swain, we'll see. There's people who say he's late first round. There's people who have him, especially in the online draft community, top five, top 10. Swain is such a fascinating player. He spent 2 years at Xavier, didn't do much. You know, he's fine, but he wasn't necessarily.
I saw him many times, being an East Coast guy.
Solid player, but not like a guy people were talking about as a lottery pick. Then he goes to Texas and becomes the most efficient isolation scorer in the country without a jumper, without taking many threes at all because his shot is so ugly, but he has great touch. So we're not going to see him shooting a lot of jumpers this month in March Madness, but for NBA fans watching Swain, especially if Texas does play BYU in the first round, you're watching a guy who's made over 80% of his free throws on 300-plus attempts in college, over 50% of his floaters. He has touch near the rim, touch from the line. He just has this, like, broken jumper. Yeah. It's ugly looking.
It's mechanical. It's step A, step B.
Everything's wrong with it. There's, like, eight parts on the jumper that he needs to completely overhaul. And that's why he lives in the paint at the restricted area. Over half of his shots came at the rim in his college career, according to CBB Analytics. And he finishes at an elite level with scoop layups, offhand, strong hand, wrong foot, floaters, touch shots, through contact. Like, the dude is a great finisher, very fun, defensive playmaker on top of that as well. You can talk yourself into Swain as like a top 10 guy pretty easily.
You could. If you're a believer that you can overhaul the shot, then I would say that's a good bet. That is easier said than done.
Yes.
Yeah, and look, I get it. The free throw indicators are great, but it also feels like there's a mental component to his shooting, because I'll tell you what, if you watch him shoot grenades, it's not as mechanical, right? Because there's no time. You just have to shoot it without thinking. And it looks a lot smoother. So part of me thinks that it's a mental block for him as a shooter, because, you know, he's not pulling up with 18 seconds on the shot clock very often. So maybe there's, you know, a sports psychology aspect. Maybe it is just we got to fix the base and raise the release. And maybe teams think it's a little bit easier. But I've noticed that the grenades, he's shooting them with a lot more confidence. And he was shooting them at a good clip the last time I looked. But his downhill ability has really been impressive this year. It has. I did not notice the level of wiggle with the ball in his hands at Xavier as I've noticed this year. Like, he's got left to right, right to left. He can spin off guys. He's strong enough to absorb contact at the rim. He's got bend and flexibility midair. So it's really you know, impressive stuff. And the playmaking, it's okay. He has the ball in his hands a lot.
Sometimes it's like, you know, I pick up my dribble, look around.
He picks up his dribble a lot in the paint, you know, and I think that's normal. This is the first year that he's tasked with basically being, I don't know, an initiator.
He's no savant, no orchestrator yet.
Yeah, it's not natural. You know, so he's okay.
At least he's willing.
He's not selfish. He just has to learn to make different reads, which if he was going back to school, you could be like, oh, this is what we're going to see. But if he's going to the league and he's not going to be shooting effectively, I just, especially as a young player, who's giving him the ball and saying, go play the same role that you played in? Now, the fact that he's already comfortable playing a different role means that, okay, he's probably going to be ready to and understand how to do the ancillary stuff. It's just like, if we're talking strictly from a ceiling perspective, he is going to need to figure out the shooting so teams can feel confident giving him the rock and letting him, you know, go rock out.
And hopefully we get that Texas matchup. Texas faces NC State for that 11 spot
to face BYU.
Not a guarantee there. So that game is on Tuesday night. We'll see if we actually do end up getting that matchup with Swain versus DeBonsa this weekend. What's your opening weekend matchup to watch from a prospect standpoint?
I think one of the most interesting storylines available for this opening week, because, you know, there's not a lot of like great prospect matchups necessarily. There are great prospects playing, but Allen Graves and Santa Clara versus Kentucky. Because there is a lot of intrigue with Allen Graves, who's like a 6'8", 230-pound, I think, locked in four. He's playing five a lot for Santa Clara, but I don't think that's going particularly well, nor would it at the next level. But he, to me, is the guy that people think Cam Boozer is going to be at the next level. Where like, oh, Cam Boozer's not going to be able to create, or he's not going to be able to score to the rim because he's an overpower guy. It's like, okay, watch Allen Graves. And that's where my concern would be a little bit more. But he's putting
still
up
a good role player.
Still a good role player. Yeah. And like some of his advanced stats are wild. He's average. His offensive rebound rate is like 15%. Defensive's like 20. So he's this crazy, like, smart rebounder. And then his steal and block numbers are both hovering around 5%. So it's like, these are like pretty special things. Now, those stock numbers in and of themselves are not like, oh, this is an NBA player. It's like Matisse Thybul, Chris Mannion. Like, these are not guys who have lit the world on fire from an NBA perspective. But he's got more to his game from an offensive perspective than those other guys have. So it's like, but the thing that NBA teams are a little more cautious about is that he didn't play a lot of top-end competition. He's a redshirt freshman. They haven't, like, is this a little bit of, like, smoke and mirrors, fool's gold? When he played Gonzaga, he struggled a little bit, right? And, like, Gonzaga's the standard there. So now he gets to play Kentucky, who does not have the year that I think Kentucky fans wanted to have.
Still a much better barometer test than many other games on the schedule.
Still a better test.
Yes.
So getting to see Allen Graves and Santa Clara go up against Kentucky, this blue blood program, and if he can go and do the same things he's doing, and it even, you know, it'd be nice if they advance, but even if he just shows that, okay, I'm not going to be completely overwhelmed against, you know, Marino, I think that goes a long way for his draft stock, because he's a guy who said that he intends on being a pro.
Yeah.
Like, he's married. You know, he's a young guy, but he's married already. He wants to...
Lucky guy. Wish I met someone young. This is what it is. 35 and single.
Love my wife. But he's married. You know, he wants to take the next step and become a pro. So as of now, and who knows, you know, some school throws a big NIL bag and teams are saying, hey, we like you in the, you know, 35 range, you know, and who knows, once you get to the second round, maybe he changes his mind. But as of now, he says he wants to be in. This is a big test for, is he actually going to be in? Because if he balls out, I think that'll kind of stamp him in the same way that, like, Neek Clifford last year balled out. Now, different scenarios because Neek was a little older, but, you know, he became a name that even, you know, more casual viewers knew at that point.
Married at 20 years old. Very fortunate. Santa Clara, Kurt Rambis, Steve Nash, Jalen Williams, to Brandon Pajimski, to Allen Graves. We'll see.
Pretty good pros.
Who knows? Pretty good. You never know. That's a good one. Dream round two matchups. I'd love to see Texas Tech, Alabama.
Yeah.
Phylon, Anderson, two small, tough guards. Filon on that side, he's a sophomore, comes back, he doubles his points, becomes a better shooter, starts answering that question. Really good herky-jerky driver. Yeah. It'd be fun to watch him go against Christian Anderson, who has run more pick and rolls than anybody in the nation, even more than Bennett Sturts. He doesn't do a lot else besides run. You know, when it comes to self-creation, it's out of pick and roll a lot for him. But he's elite at it.
Oh, yeah.
1.2 points per pick and roll, according to Synergy. He's an elite shooter off the catch, off the dribble as well. Offers a bit of value off ball. He's just undersized. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the concern with him. And without JT Toppin, Texas Tech is a bit more limited. But I think that would be a really fun guard-to-guard prospect matchup. And I hope we get to see it round two. I'd love that.
Me too, because I think that's kind of the storyline of this draft after the Big Four, mm-hmm. you know, is that the point guard group is just loaded.
Oh my God.
You know, and
so
like,
many names. Yeah,
you will never find a big board that has the same order because you can, it's like a buffet. Like if you like this, you could, you know, like, and Filon and Christian Anderson are two of the guys in that group who came back as sophomores, both improved in a huge way. And to go head to head on a huge stage like this, it's like we could really mm-hmm. see. And you could see both of them going off, too, which is the cool thing. I'm really intrigued to see that matchup just because I think this guard crop is so competitive. And, like, who knows? Maybe for some people that's the separator of stepping up in the big spotlight against one of your peers.
And it does matter. I mean, like, it's just one game. Mm-hmm. But it's one game on the biggest stage with the brightest lights and the most pressure and the loudest crowd. And like, it matters. All over the years, any executive I talk to, they're like, yeah, of course these games matter. This is why like the G League Ignite in part was such a failure.
Right.
Because these guys are playing in an empty arena that nobody cares about. Yeah. Nobody's going to games. It's scouts in the crowd.
I mean, you were there for Scoot Wemby.
Yes.
Was that arena even...
It was like what I remember arena vibe wise, it was just too loud. Like the music was too loud. Everything was too loud. It's because they're overcompensating for the fact that it was just a bunch of scouts in the crowd.
Yeah.
You know, there's some fans. I don't want to dismiss that, but no, it wasn't like a raucous environment.
Right.
It never was. And so I think like it matters when you play in that environment, you play at a high level and you come through and you power through the anxiety that affects you as an 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old, 27-year-old, in some cases in college basketball at this point. I mean, it's just true.
Chad Baker Mazzara leaving the team.
See you later.
Because he's already looking
well, turns out he's 40.
Yes.
He's older than us. That's why he's gone. how old was he really, 28?
I think he was like 26.
26?
I think he was 26, you know.
That's incredible. How old was he? I'm looking this up. How old was 26?
Yeah, 26.
26. Just turned 26 in January. Just a young guy. Young guy. Yeah, really strange. So what's your round two dream matchup, Corey? What do you got?
St. John's versus Kansas. One, you know, that means that hopefully that Darren Peterson has played well in game one. But, you know, I'm a New Yorker. The Johnnies hold a special place in my heart. That was the first live basketball game that I had attended when I was a kid. A bunch of my family members went to St. John's, and they're in the middle of this run, this resurgence that, quite frankly, I never thought that I would see in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. You know, with Rick Pitino coming in and leading the team to back-to-back Big East titles in the tournament and just in conference. Now, you know, as far as how far can they go, I just don't know if they have the guard power to have like a deep run. But Zubi Ejiofor is playing like out of his mind. And he has a little like revenge potentially in him because he started his career at Kansas. Flory Badinga is another guy who would, I think, give him problems potentially. I really like Dylan Mitchell. I think he's been awesome this year for St. John's. You know, obviously the shooting is a gigantic concern. I mean, anytime you got a guy who's like improved his shooting, and I think he's still under 50% from the free throw line, not awesome, but all of the other things that he does, you know, from just getting out in transition and being athletic, he's got a 3-to-1 assist to turnover ratio. He rebounds both sides of the ball. Just like I would love to see him on Darren Peterson and see how Darren deals with that situation. So I just want to see Darren go up against tough matchups and see what he has in him on the biggest stage, because, you know, I know we talked about it at the top, but he's got a real chance to once again go from like, all right, everybody's like tentatively keeping him in like the one or two range to like, no, I'm the guy you thought I was. Yes. So that's interesting.
He can make himself say, I am the number one.
Yeah. He does, like he did against BYU.
Yes. He has that opportunity in front of him.
Yeah.
If he plays full games.
Yes.
And we'll see. And doesn't pull himself out. I'm hopeful. I mean, look. All year long, I began the season with DeBonta as my number one.
Yep.
I still have him my number one. I've flirted with having Peterson number one. I'm not ruling out putting him number one at the end before the draft in late June.
It's a marathon.
But there's exactly, and it's not over yet. Even after March is over, there's still time for things to change. But this really is the month where for him to prove it to a lot of people, more so than doing it in workouts. People want to see it on the court, in games. Don't hear about this in theory solution.
Yeah.
They want evidence. It's like asking for a raise. You want to show your boss the return on investment before you get the raise. It's not because you're not paying for potential always. Right. Sometimes NBA teams do that. They pay for potential.
Yeah.
It's the truth. But when it comes to drafting players, teams want to see the reality of it when it comes to taking a number one pick. When you have a Cam Boozer, you have an AJ DeBonta as an alternative. When you have a Darius Acuff and all these other guys, you're like, we'll just go with that guy.
Yeah.
So this is a month for Darren Peterson to prove it, and we'll see if he does. Corey, it's time for a 2025, way too early, NBA redraft. Is it early? Maybe.
We've seen some other ones already.
There were some in October. So we're safe to do one now in the middle of March. We're going to go through the order as the teams picked. Starting with number one, the Dallas Mavericks. Are they still taking Cooper Flagg, Corey? We're going to alternate picks starting with you at number one.
Okay. Yeah, I still think they're taking Cooper Flagg.
Okay.
Yeah. Don't
pretty obviously, right?
Yeah, yes. Because it's not just the on the court product. Cooper's been sensational this year, but it's also like he is a real draw, you know, as a potential face of the franchise. So there's multiple levels to it. But it's not like you're bypassing the skill for just the ticket sales. He is legitimately, you know, as a 6'8" wing who does everything at a high level. Now, you know, or at least will project to do those things at a high level. You can go to him at the end of games. He ran through, you know, the Giannis at point guard portion of his time earlier in the year where he got those reps, which will make him better in the long term. And I think once Dallas builds this team around him, you're going to look at a guy who I think, you know, you could very clearly see him having that Jason Tatum-esque impact on that franchise. Shows up every day, competes his ass off, I think as a two-way player, it's easy. It's an easy choice.
It's definitely an easy choice. I mean, he had that stretch end of January against Conn and the Hornets, 49 points. Then against Houston, 34 points. Then against Boston, 36 points. And then against the Spurs, he had 32.
He's supposed to be in this class.
And he's supposed to be in this class. And then he had 14 against the Spurs on the next game. And then 27 against the Suns when he got hurt. Since he got back, he's starting to pick it back up recently. He had two really good games against the Cavaliers after a bit of a rocky start after his return. Cooper, there have been moments where he already looks like one of the 20 best players in the game. I'd say it's safely more of like the 35th or the 40th best player. But the fact you're saying that about a guy who is 18 at the beginning of the season, to me, when I evaluated Cooper last year, I felt like he was one of the safest number one picks that I've ever evaluated since I started doing this in 2013. Since I started doing it like as a fan when I was a kid. The question was, what level does he reach as with his upside?
Yeah.
The way his handle has improved since high school to Duke to now suggests that this guy can be a MVP candidate, not just a multi-time all-star as a role player, a high-end star role player, but a mega star who can be the leader of your franchise, the best player on a championship team. So yes, Cooper Flagg still number one.
Choice.
Things get interesting at number two. San Antonio Spurs. I said at the time I would have traded down, not taken Dylan Harper. I would have targeted Con Knipple. I think today they would take Con Knipple over Dylan Harper. So we're taking Con Knipple with a second pick for the San Antonio Spurs. I think if they could redo it, they would. That is not to say Dylan Harper won't end up better long term. There's a chance of that. Dylan Harper is a great downhill attacker, active defender. We've seen how he can look on nights where his shot is falling, but it's not always. If the Spurs, a team that does have some iffy shooters, had Con Knipple, who's made 40% of his threes on 8 attempts per game, one of the best shooting seasons we've ever seen from a young player, from anybody ever.
Yeah.
If Con Knipple was added to this team, with his shooting only, it would be additive.
Yeah.
Not to mention his pick and roll creation ability, his ability in two-man actions and dribble handoffs, and the fact that he can play on ball and off ball and make good decisions as a passer and finish at the rim. He's strong. He would fit in defensively with that team as well. I think the Spurs would be more so the favorites over the Thunder simply if they had Con Knipple, who has been one of the 40 or 45 best players in the NBA this year as a rookie. He's been one of the best 50 best players in the league. So I'd say Knipple over Dylan Harper today. Would you agree with that, though, Corey?
I had Con at number 2.
Okay, so we're on the same page still.
I flirted with Con even, like, for a second. I was like, could Con be the best player in this draft when we look back?
That's a legitimate question. Is there a chance of that because his shooting ability is that special and because he's shown what he can do on ball? Do you think there is an actual real chance of that?
I do.
Really?
I do think that.
You'd go that far.
I think if you were like, you are our Luka Harden heliocentric guy, like his peak, like, I don't know, could he be a 27, 28, 8-8 guy? Could he? He could, I think. I mean, you know, like, you know, he's shorter than Luka, right? But he's so comfortable with the ball in his hands. He's so smart. And, like, he's going to get better. So, like, what does better look like when you're already a 50, 40, 90 guy? You know, like,
I know.
You know, like, he's going to whatever team he's on, you're going to have an elite offense, a chance at having an elite offense. So, just the playmaking feel, the vision, the comfortability, and the fact that he has held up defensively, you know, it's just, oh, he's slow footed. And it's like, no, he's just smart. He moves well and he's strong and he just knows when to contest. Like, he's a two-way guy. I think there's a chance. It would be really hard for an organization to make that bet, you know, if they were redrafting. But I think it's a possibility.
I wouldn't rule it out. I don't think so. I think I currently favor him for rookie of the year over Cooper today. Still a month left. We'll see if that changes. That's like neck and neck for me between Cooper and Con Knipple. I just think the fact Con has done it on a team that's in the playoff conversation, that's had this great surge mid-year, that has a chance to actually make the playoffs and who knows, make some noise in the first round that helps team performance. The fact he's doing it in a winning context. But long-term, I'd still take Cooper. Of course, that's why we have him going first in this redraft. But Con Knipple looks better than anticipated.
It makes you think.
Which is why we have him going second to the Spurs. With the third pick, the Sixers in reality took VJ Edgecombe. Where are you going here in our redraft?
I would take Dylan Harper.
Okay.
Yeah. Not the cleanest fit, but I think that Dylan has shown that he's capable of playing with other guys who need the ball in his hands. And he can kind of play a role that many people didn't anticipate him being able to play so cleanly as a rookie. And I still think, though, that he has this on-ball juice and potential as a guy who does dominate touches that, you know, I'm a little less confident in with VJ Edgecombe. And VJ is terrific. I've been watching him at, you know, at Lehigh for years, like since he was a junior in high school. I've been following him. I love VJ Edgecombe's game. I just think that Dylan has higher level that he can get to, and he's shown what level of defender that he could be, you know, which people didn't always see at Rutgers. But it doesn't necessarily shock me. I went to the USC Rutgers game, and there were moments he had like 4 steals in that game. He was diving on the floor. Like, his dad is one of the, you know, best, you know, perimeter defenders of his time. Like, he was born for that. So I just think he could be more of a chameleon than people think. And him and Tyrese Maxey, especially because he's got the positional size too, that would be so dynamic, getting downhill, like carving up defenses, getting out in transition. And Dylan's so good at the rim. I don't know.
It's almost a coin flip for me. I'd lean Dylan Harper, though. I had Harper ahead of Edgecombe in my pre-draft ranking, so I'd stick with that here if I were the Sixers and Harper were on the board. Ultimately, I mean, Harper, the questions about his shot long-term, off the dribble, he has not been good, around 10% on dribble jumper threes, around 40% on dribble jumper twos, but it's not like Edgecombe's any better there.
Right.
They've both, I think Edgecombe is 36.2 7% on catch and shoot threes. Harper is 36.2%. They're both below average,
right,
as rookies. But I would lean Harper because of the on-ball engine potential that you're talking about next to Tyrese Maxey in that backcourt. So that's a close one, though. Moving on to number four, Con Knipple in reality went here to the Charlotte Hornets. He is no longer on the board. We have some nominees: VJ Edgecombe, Ace Bailey, Trey Johnson. I think it's VJ Edgecombe here.
Okay, yeah.
It's VJ Edgecombe to the Charlotte Hornets with the fourth pick in our redraft here. I wouldn't even think about any other direction at this point right now if I were Charlotte. I would go with Edgecombe, my two-way guy, not bringing the shooting that I have with Con, but he can play on ball, can play off ball.
I mean, the transition opportunities with him, LaMelo.
Oh, my. That could be beautiful.
Yeah.
That could have been, that's a fun alternate reality to think about, actually.
You're going from the most groundbound guy in the draft to like one of the most explosive.
They probably wouldn't win as many games.
Right.
But they would be still exciting and fun to watch.
You know, what's fun about VJ is that he can almost be like a supercharged, like Alex Caruso. You know, like he doesn't have to be like this big time scorer. I think that's kind of been like icing on the cake for him, that he's shown a lot of this like on-ball scoring juice, but he could be a guy like who just wreaks havoc defensively, crashes the glass, coming in out of nowhere, you know, makes these big winning plays. Like, he has the potential to do that too. And I think he's done a lot of that for Philly, but I think like stylistically, he would fit with Charlotte so
very fun.
Well, like sliding in between LaMelo and Brandon Miller, and like VJ's your smaller, the small guy on your team there too, like, and what he brings defensively, it would be a lot of fun.
With the fifth pick, the Utah Jazz took Ace Bailey. In reality, our top four is the same, just in a different order. At this point, we have Ace Bailey, Trey Johnson, Jeremiah Fears, Yegor Demin, Colin Murray-Boyles. That order is still alive. Yeah. That's the original order. Is Utah still taking Ace Bailey here, or are you going in a different direction?
Would Utah still take them? Maybe. We know Ainge likes his RSCI guys. Mm-hmm. And Ace has been really good this year. Yeah. He's been really good this year.
But you wouldn't?
No.
No?
No.
Where are you going?
I would take Derek Queen.
Oh, Derek Queen.
Yeah.
Derek Queen. What makes me the case of this guy who can't play a lick of defense?
I love Derek Queen. I think that this is going to be the guy who maybe it takes a couple of years. But, you know, he might end up in the same, different player stylistically because he's more of a driver. He's got handle. I don't know. To me, he was always this weird combination of like Jalen Williams and Şengün, because he's a little wingier and as a creator than Şengün. And, you know, I think that like defensively, yeah, I get it. I don't view him as like a five necessarily. Like, I think that he's capable because of his ball handling. I think his lateral movement defensively is better than his like rim protection ability. And he's got quick hands. You pair him next to a Walker Kessler. Laurie's shown he can play the three. You're still really big in the front court here. I mean, I know that they traded for Jaren, but I just think like as a playmaker, as a downhill threat, and then there's low-hanging fruit that like he's a guy who's shown that he has touch from the free throw line. I think he'll space the floor eventually, and he's just this super unique weird weapon that I think like down the line is going to be able to carry an offense in a way that I just think is hard to find. He's like an outlier. I like outliers. So I'm going to go with Derek Queen. I had him third on my board coming into that cycle, and I still think he's had some really, really high moments that I just go, man, you don't find that guy in every draft.
I worry.
And I get the concerns. I totally get the concerns.
You know why I worry in part? It's nothing to do with Derek Queen. It has everything to do with Alperen Şengün. Mm-hmm. If that's the construct you're kind of hoping for, I've got my concerns with Şengün
in
this developed state. With where he is in Houston now, there are moments where he's a defensive liability. There are moments he's a liability with not bringing enough as a perimeter player, as a shooter. Sometimes it feels like he's a predictable player. With Derek Queen, in theory, this year he's shooting 78.6% from the free throw line. He's a high touch player inside the paint. In theory, in time, that sub 30% from three should become a high 30% from three, 37, 38, 39% from three. But there's No guarantee.
But Houston hasn't necessarily done the best job like building a roster that accentuates the strengths if you were trying to bring out the best offense.
But it's also hard to sometimes do that with a player as a shaky defender and a shaky shooter.
It's hard.
It's like there's different degrees of the Ben Simmons problem when it comes to offense shooting with the wrong hand. And defensively, Simmons could hold his own.
Right.
Şengün can't. Queen can't yet. We'll see. I wouldn't go with Derrick Queen at five, but I understand the logic considering his upside. He's an outlier,
It's an upside play.
It's a swing, just like Ace Bailey is an upside just like swing. Ace Bailey. And that's why with the sixth pick as the Washington Wizards, they wanted Ace Bailey on draft night. Well, they got him our redraft. Yeah. They're getting Ace Bailey. They get their swing. That's where I'm going with the sixth pick here. Ace Bailey going to the Washington Wizards as they dreamed of on draft night. They take their big swing. We've seen Ace Bailey hit some highs and a lot of lows this year with the Utah Jazz. At his size, 6'6", 6'7", brings enough to the table with his youth where you're like, okay, we'll take a swing here and figure things out over time. So the Wizards getting Ace Bailey here with the sixth pick. I feel like this is me thinking through the lens of the Wizards. Mm-hmm. But even when I think it through my own lens, I'm not sure I'd go with Cedric Coward, a little older. I'm not sure I'd go with Carter Bryant. I want some on-ball juice. Mm-hmm. And Trey Johnson, Jeremiah Fears, those guys, there's fit questions with their existing infrastructure there. So I feel good about Ace Bailey here to the Washington Wizards.
Ace has been awesome for Utah. I mean, look, has he been one of the top three rookies? Probably not. But he's doing all of the things that you drafted him to do. And I mean, one of the cool things about seeing him at Rutgers was like, he has so much off the ball game to what he can bring to a team. I mean, some of the shots that he was hitting off the move, off balance at Rutgers, you're like, oh my gosh, like this is so natural. It's so hard to find at his height, right? So even if he never develops the Paul George, Brandon Miller wiggle, you know, he still is just able to get clean offense through all of the stuff he does off the ball. Crazy athlete, right? Like two-way player. He's going to get stronger and he's going to be, I think, a really good defensive player on that end. You know, his weak side shot blocking has been, you know, something that he's always been good at. So I, especially for an upside play, like there's still so much untapped potential with Ace to be an impact player. And he's a guy that can be completely comfortable playing off of Trae Young. And, you know, that'll make his life easier in a lot of regards.
Number seven, New Orleans Pelicans. In reality, they took Jeremiah Fears with this selection. At this point on our board, we have so far taken number one, Cooper Flagg to the Mavs, two, Spurs, Konkanipple, two, Spurs, Konkanipple, three, Dylan Harper going to the Sixers, four, Hornets, VJ Edgecombe, five, Derek Queen to the Jazz, six, Washington Wizards get Ace Bailey. So number seven on the board, who are you taking for the New Orleans Pelicans?
I'm going to take Cedric Coward.
Okay, I like it.
Yeah. You know, I think there were concerns just with Cedric, you know, because of how, you know, where he played earlier in his college career. Then he hurts himself. He plays six games. And it was like, all right, well, we got this guy who's 6'6", chiseled, crazy 7 foot plus wingspan, gigantic hands. I met him at pre-draft.
Huge.
And I was like, where'd my hand go? You know, like when I shook his hand, he was a great kid, great story. And then he comes in, you know, he's been in and out of the lineup. So hopefully there's, you know, not a lot of like, oh, this is going to be a guy we only see for 40 to 50 games a year. But beautiful three-point stroke. I mean, I think his handle has continued to evolve. 7'2 wingspan or whatever it is, like he's going to be able to defend. He's got great hands. Just easy to slot in anywhere. And I think has some on-ball juice that he's continuing to develop that he's displayed this year for Memphis. Even if he's a little older than some of the other prospects that are still on the board, I still think he's been terrific. And because of his physical profile, I think he has just as much potential to be a big-time impact guy.
Everybody's developmental trajectory is different in life and in sports. Some people start fast and they fizzle. Some people start fast and they keep on ascending. Some people start slow and then boom, out of nowhere, they figure out their path or they figure out their game in the case of basketball. Cedric Coward is one of those guys. He was a bit of a slow starter.
Slow burn.
And then he figured things out and he started ascending and then he played six games, as you said. And now he's been one of the five best rookies in basketball. He's a lock to be first team all rookie. And I had him seventh on my board last year. I think I still feel good about having him seventh here. I think if I'm re-ranking my players, I'd have Cedric Howard a little bit higher than seven. But the redraft order, I still think those upside swings at number six, I'd still like lean in Nate Smealy. And then number seven, I do like the safety of Cedric Howard. They're adding some certainty, especially knowing what comes later when they trade their pick to move up for your guy, Derek Queen.
I'll tell you what, draft lottery night last year was one of those moments, but this year it has the opportunity to be like that too.
Oh my God. I mean, dude, the fact is, you look at the draft order right now, I'm currently on Tankathon. I'm going to hit the simulate lottery button. I'm hitting the button. We see the Hawks, they move down to seven. The Pelicans, see, this is a result like, whoo!
Yeah.
If you're a Pelicans fan, you breathe a sigh of relief.
Yeah. Did DeJounte Murray ball out the rest of the year, please?
You're breathing a sigh of relief if the Hawks end up with the seventh pick. Yes. But boy, oh boy, there's a chance that they move
up. There's a universe where.
I mean, because they have the Bucks odds and the New Orleans odds, Atlanta does. So, close to a 50% chance they end up in the top four with one of those two picks. Pelicans screwed up doing that trade. I don't care how much you like Derek Queen.
They
shouldn't have done that deal. All right, so number eight, still on the board, Trey Johnson, Jeremiah Fears, Yegor, who they did take in reality, Colin Murray Boyles, Kaman Malawach. Part of me feels like if I pass on Trey Johnson here, I'm underrating him after really liking him last year. Yeah. I really liked Trey Johnson last year, and he's had an okay year.
He's shooting the ball really well.
Yeah, I mean, I wish he shot it a little better.
He's doing what he does.
He's who he is. 40% off the dribble from three, great number. Yeah. 35% off the catch. I'd like to see that be a bit better. 49% off the dribble for mid-range as well. So he's getting buckets. He just hasn't had like that. I said, I think it was around my my post-All-Star break episode, like things to watch for in the second half. I'm waiting for that Trey Johnson explosion. Mm-hmm. Like that 30-point, 40-point banger from a guy who just goes nuclear in the second half as a rookie where you're like, whoa, oh my God.
You know what I like though? Him telling Trey Young to start moving off the ball.
Yes. Because Trey Johnson does that, and he's willing to. Like, if Trey Young starts moving off ball, it would be great.
I like his confidence. I like his moxie.
I do like his confidence. I think I'm going to just go Trey Johnson here.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm going to go Trey Johnson to the Nets. He's like everything you wish Cam Thomas was. He brings the spark plug scoring ability and the ability to move off ball and the ability to pass, the willingness to pass. With a bit more size.
A bit more willingness.
Yeah,
to pass.
Willingness. So I'm going to go with Trey Johnson here, even though I'm looking at some of the other names on the board and I'm like, I want to go with this guy. But I'm going to go with Trey Johnson to the Nets with the eighth pick. Ninth pick is the Toronto Raptors.
Yeah.
So the Raptors take Colin Murray Boyles in reality. Who are you going here with this pick?
I'm still going with Colin Murray.
Okay. Staying with him. Okay.
I probably would have taken him maybe a couple of spots higher, potentially, if it was just a ranking. He's so impactful defensively already that it's almost scary to think of what he might end up being. And he's a good passer and he's shooting threes. You know, this was the big question. Now, he shot them on pretty low volume in high school. And I always kind of thought like the touch could be there. But the fact that he's at least getting some up, he's not Trey Johnson from behind the line, but he's at least attempting them. He's super long. He's super strong. And I think strength is just so important when we look at, you know, how successful a prospect could be. At this point, like, it's the brain, the feel, and an intersection that combines some kind of strength with it, too. And he is so strong, so physical. He gets up off the floor quick near the rim. He's got good touch. He can handle the ball, like, in a straight line. Really good vision. He's just going to be a winning player. Will he be an all-star? I don't know. Maybe if he ends up on the right team, maybe like a one-time all-star or something, you know, a Luol Deng all-star appearance. But I think he's going to impact winning basketball for a very long time on whatever team he plays on. And I'm sure Toronto hopes that it's Toronto forever.
I think that's a good choice. I like that choice. I think Murray Boyles, his defensive ability is potentially game-changing. Yes. And offensively, we'll see how he develops over time. But ultimately, I still think I'd lean Murray Boyles at this point, too. With that said, you know, we have on the board Yegor,
yep.
who is shot 38% from three this year, over 80% from the free throw line. Shooting was one of the biggest questions with him entering the year, entering the draft. And then as a rookie, he shot the ball really well. We still have Jeremiah Fears, solid point guard. We still have Kaman Malawach, mm-hmm. who the Suns did take in reality with this 10th pick. Malawach, he hasn't played a lot. Looked pretty good without Mark Williams for a handful of games. He had a 5-block game against the New Orleans Pelicans, blocked Zion three times yep. in the game, blocked DeJounte Murray. He looks great. He looks awesome in the G League. Exactly. So do you go Malawach? Do you go Yegor? Do you go Carter Bryant, who in the second half of this year is, like I said this on my pod last week, he's listed at 6'7 with a 7-foot wingspan. He just looks so much bigger to me than that. Like I look at him and I'm like, that measurement has to be wrong. That can't be right. He looks like a 7'4 wingspan.
Like, big shoulders. You know, like he
looks 7'4 wingspan. He looks huge.
He looks like one of those old school. I was watching like a Larry Johnson mixtape the other day. And you look at like what NBA players used to look like, where they like looked like bodybuilders, a lot of them. And like Carter Bryant reminds me of a guy who could have been one of those 90s, yeah. like just brolic dudes, just because physically he's a marvel.
Any other names that belong in that spot for 10th? Any others?
You know what? The wild card, the two wild cards, Yon Berenguer
uh-huh.
yeah. and Hugo Gonzalez.
I like it. Okay.
The international Rob.
Yeah, Berenguer looks good in minutes. It's too bad Chris Finch hates to play young players. And then Hugo, total opposite. Joe Mazzulla will play anybody yeah. and everybody. He'll play G Leaguer Ron Harper Jr.
Yep.
He'll start on defending Kevin Durant.
I'm so happy for Ron Harper Jr.
Oh, my God.
Jr.
Oh, he's developed so much.
I was in the building at Rutgers when he hit the game winner against Purdue when Purdue was number one. And, you know, I feared for my life as they all cleared the stands because I had no emotional attachment to the moment other than it was awesome. But it's awesome to see him like really carving out a niche.
And then Hugo.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the steals chaos. Of the draft. He's a chaos creator defensively as a rebounder. He's improved his shot. He plays within the flow of that offense. How do you go from playing 7 minutes per game for Real Madrid to being a rotation fixture on one of the best teams in the league? It doesn't make sense to me. Can you explain this, Corey? I don't get it.
Well, if you looked at that Real Madrid roster, I guess it was as deep in that league as an NBA roster would look like. So sometimes I would just look at the players that were on that team and I go, yeah, who is he supposed to play in front of?
Well, now, who is that? I mean, you could easily make the argument with the Celtics and yet they find him minutes.
Yeah. Longer games.
Sure, 48 minutes.
Yeah.
That's true.
But this is why, scouting is not an exact science, and it's why priors matter. It's why for these international guys, you also have to look at, you know, the youth competitions because, you know, he chose to stay in or whatever his contract was that he couldn't get out of or whatever. And then you look at guys like Kasparis Giakoumenis who came stateside and played in college and were able to just play 35 minutes a night and what that could do for your draft stock. It's why it's hard with these guys who are only playing 7 minutes because they're behind ex-NBA guys who are overseas. And Hugo, like, if you looked at the boards coming into the year, he was potentially a top 10 guy. So it's shocking that he's making an impact on a Celtics team that is looking like they could be a championship contender. But also, he could have been a top 10 pick. You know, like you can make an argument that he should have been a lottery player the whole time. He was just in, you know, a situation that was not conducive to being able to put up gaudy numbers. So
with that 10th pick, all that said, I think Hugo is deserving of getting a mention. I think all these names are. I'm going to take Carter Bryant.
Okay.
I'm taking him slightly over Yegor Diomin.
Yep.
Carter Bryant to me just looks like a 3-and-D monster.
Yep.
Just a
athletic
beast. I mean, Malawach, you have Mark Williams there. Malawach could very well end up the guy long term. But with Mark Williams there, maybe I'm drafting a little bit too much for need here. But Mark Williams has looked great.
There's a lot of potential with
Carter Bryant. Could be a great two-way player.
Let's just like zoom out for a little bit with the Spurs. I mean, think about putting out a lineup. Let's find them a young four to grow with. A Victor Wembanyama, Stephen Castle, Carter Bryant, and Dylan Harper. Defensively.
Insane.
And pick your defensive-minded four.
Insane.
What does that look like when those guys are in their prime? Who
70 wins?
Who scores on that group?
I know. There's like interchangeability from 1 to 4. They can switch across positions, no issues. And then you have Victor Wembanyama deterring everybody from wanting to sniff the paint. Like, you see some of the plays, players just not even considering going into the paint against Wemby. That's going to grow even greater in a greater magnitude over the years as he becomes a better defender, a little bit smarter, a little bit quicker with his rotations, a little bit more fear. He instills more fear in the opponent as well over time, because more guys are going to be like, I'm good. I'm good. It's just going to happen over time. It's going to increase.
Before. I know what's going on.
Exactly. So ultimately, I think with that group, we got a good little redraft here. Most of the same names. You took 1, 3, 5, 7, 9. Cooper Flagg, Dylan Harbour, Derek Queen, Cedric Howard, Calamari Boyles, me, 2, 10, the even numbers. Con Knipple, VJ Edgecombe, Ace Bailey, Trace Johnson, Carter Bryant. So Jeremiah Fears, Yegor Dioman, Kamon Malawach fell out of our top 10. But that more so is just a testament to the depth of this draft class. It is a great 2025 draft class, as we've seen this year in the NBA. The 2026 draft class, we're going to watch a lot of these guys in March Madness. I'm excited this month. I'm fired up, Corey. We're entering the best time of the year. March Madness, NBA playoffs, pre-draft season coming up.
Yeah.
This is when I'm at my happiest of the entire years.
The right Northeast now. Is starting to warm up.
The weather's getting better. Snow's melting.
Yeah, I mean, this is the best time. It's the best time to be a basketball fan, because there's something every night to watch. That's
100%. And the best news is Killian Hayes signed a 2-year deal with the Kings. He's going to be in our lives a lot longer. He had a great game on Sunday night, 16 points, I believe. Efficient scoring. Mm-hmm. Killian Hayes, please. Figure out how to score, Killian Hayes. Figure out how to score, because you can defend. You can pass. You can get to the rim. You can do it all except score. So hopefully last night is a sign of things to come for Killian Hayes, me, and the Sacramento Kings. Just make me look a little less dumb, Killian. That's all. Make me look a little less dumb. Corey, you are very smart. You guys at No Ceilings do an outstanding job. As always, thank you so much for joining me today,
man. I appreciate you having me, man.
All right, thank you, Corey, for joining me. Coming up, we have two special guests, Cam and Caden Boozer from the Duke Blue Devils. Talked to them a couple weeks ago about what they're preparing for with the draft and March Madness coming up. So here's Cam and Caden Boozer.
We'll be right back.
All right, here with Cam and Caden Boozer out of Duke. How you guys doing today?
Good.
Doing great.
You guys are joining me on behalf of State Farm. How much NBA are you guys watching this year? I know you're busy with college, of course.
A good amount, focusing on college, of course, because, scouting, stuff like that. But I watch, every here and there.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, when we're not scouting or we're not having games, we're definitely watching. Like, there was a really good game, Spurs and Pistons, I think, earlier in the week. That was a really good game to watch. So, we're able to watch a few games here and there, but it's hard with the traveling and how many games we have in a week.
Back in 2012, you guys were just 4 years old. I'll always remember the time your dad painted his hair. So you probably don't remember that when it happened, but have you ever made fun of him over the years? Seeing the images of that.
I mean, for sure. Obviously, when we got older and we started having phones, the video would go viral and like the pictures would go viral. So we make little jokes here and there.
Cam, you've had one of the best freshman seasons that I've ever seen. People in high school at one point, obviously you've won at every level. People said his creation needed to improve. That got better. People said the three-point shot needs to get better. That got better. What specific skill do you need to improve the most now?
I'll say, first of all, whoever says my three-point shot needs to improve clearly just didn't watch me. My senior year, I shot 47 from three. Right now I'm shooting 40% from three, so that would just be incorrect. But going to the next level, I just think playing with more space and things like that is going to make the game so much easier. But I mean, there's a lot of areas you need to improve on. After the season, we're going to go back, watch a lot of film on just throughout the whole year, things need to tune up, things like that. But right now, we're just focusing on right now, finishing the year. We're trying to compete at the highest level right now. We're going to March. So I'm not thinking about any of that right now. I'm thinking about what I got to do right now and how my team win.
Caden, according to Synergy Sports, you've scored 1 point points per pick and roll this year, one of the highest marks in the nation in the 91st percentile. Who are some pick and roll creators that inspire you?
Obviously, like Chris Paul, Jason Kidd, just really, really smart point guards, even like Tyus Jones and Trey Jones, just really good point guards that have a lot of poise and try to make the right read every time. And obviously with the team that we have, the talent that's around me, it makes it a lot easier to score in those pick and roll situations with bigs like Pat and obviously the shooters that we have. So I feel like my teammates make it a lot easier for me to look good. And just we have a really good team. I feel like I've benefited because of that.
Cam, you guys, when you two are on the court together this season, according to CBB Analytics, Duke has a 132 offensive rating, one of the best combinations on the team. In some ways, I feel like, no surprise, the offense clicks when you guys are on the floor together. In your evaluation, Cam, what works when Caden's on the floor as one of the facilitators on the team?
We tell him all the time, run your team, you know what I'm saying? I think that's the big thing for him, being a true point guard. Getting guys in the right spots, touching the paint, creating. It's one of his biggest attributes, obviously. When you have guys who can create for others, it makes the offense a lot easier. So that's the biggest thing.
And Caden, in high school, Cam mentioned high school numbers earlier. In high school, you shot about 40% on spot-up three-pointers. This year for Duke, you're closer to around 30%. What has been kind of the difference for you? I know it's a smaller sample, but in high school shooting the three compared to now, what needs to improve for you in those off-ball situations?
Like you said, it's been a smaller sample. So I think just having those opportunities and taking them, obviously, I feel like I've been a really good shooter, and obviously when I'm prepared and I'm ready to shoot, I feel like I make it. So just being more aggressive in those moments, and just taking more threes because I know I can make them. So I think just the sample size obviously makes the numbers look a little bit lower, but at the end of the day, I trust in my work, and I just have to continue to find my moments and be aggressive in those moments.
You guys mentioned that Spurs-Pistons game earlier in this week, which was one of the better games of the season. I thought it was a pretty definitive statement for San Antonio to win that and hold Cade the way they did. But I think both of those teams in their own way, they both have lineup flexibility. They can play with one big Victor out there or play him with Cornette, and then the Pistons can play with just Durin or with Beef Stew as well. They can play with different types of lineups, and that's what the recent champions have had as well, and that's what you guys have at Duke. Cam, they can play you with the five, or they can play you with Gongba. And I think that lineup flexibility is a really valuable piece that you guys have and moving forward with your own flexibility in the NBA. So I'm curious, Cam, you're obviously an unbelievable prospect. You always have been. But one of the nitpicks people have said is, well, what's he going to be defensively? I don't worry about it because I think you're showing what you can do and the way you've improved. But I'm curious, how would you describe yourself as a defensive player with how you work for Duke, with your lineup flexibility, and how you see yourself continuing to improve moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a guy who can guard 1-5. I start the year, our team was switching 1-5, and obviously I was doing that. We've been one of the best defensive teams in the country all year long. Now we've gone mostly away from switching, so it's a little different now, but you can plug me in anywhere on defense and I'll be fine for sure.
Patrick Gongba, I feel like a lot of the times he gets overlooked, at least nationally, and ultimately you guys are dominant even when he's just out there. You guys have an 88 defensive rating according to CBB Analytics when just Gongba's out there. How would you guys describe Patrick Gongba to people who have never seen him play before?
I mean, he's obviously one of the best rim protectors in the country. One of the best passers as a big. I think when he's aggressive, he's the best big in the country. And I feel like he's shown that night in and night out, playing against really good bigs and winning that matchup every time. So I just feel like we all have confidence in him. And when he's aggressive and when he's being the rim protector we know he can be, he's, I think in my opinion, the best big in the country.
Cam, how does your roles change when you're playing with a five like Gongba and when you're not?
Well, this year, for basically the majority of the season, I'm always playing with the five, whether it's Pat, whether it's Malik. I've had very few moments where I'm playing the five this year. But I'd say the biggest difference is just getting rebounding as a team, cracking down as guards, rebounding. Guys like Caden and Caleb, Dominic Slim, they've done a great job all year guard rebounding. But that's probably the biggest difference for our team, just when we go small ball.
Caden, who was your favorite player growing up?
Russell Westbrook. I always loved how hard he played, and obviously the stats were always great, but I just feel like he always brought that energy, and he just always was really good at making his teammates better. And I feel like that was just my favorite player growing up, obviously him and Kyrie. So I would say those.
How about you, Cam?
I would say Anthony Davis, you know, just versatility, what he can do at both ends of the floor. He's, I mean, especially in his earlier days in New Orleans, he was really just like a big guard, basically. You know, he can stretch the floor, he'll drive you, he'll post you up. He just does everything on the floor. So I'll say Anthony Davis was for me.
What do you think about all this tanking in the NBA right now to get a chance at someone like you?
I mean, right now I'm just focused on what we're doing right here this season at Duke, you know, like I said earlier.
What a great media trained answer. That was excellent.
I mean, yeah, but it's really the truth. You know, we talk about it every day. You got to be where your feet are. That's what we're doing. You know, we're not even talking about games after Virginia. We're focused on Virginia and that's it. So, I mean, you can call it a media trained answer, but it's really the truth.
I mean, it's the right mindset to have. Is that something that you guys feel like you developed at a younger age, or like when did that kind of come to focus on the here and now with where your feet are?
I think, especially younger age, I think, it became a really big thing in high school, obviously, when you're getting offers and you're thinking about, oh, like where I can go in the future. But at the end of the day, the best part of history is right now and what you do with it in that certain time. So I feel like when you look ahead and obviously you have your dreams and your aspirations and you can. Yeah, I learned that. You know what I'm saying? Obviously, when you have your dreams and your aspirations, you can always put that like in your mind, but you can't overly focus on it because then you ruin what you're doing in the present. So I feel like we learned it when we were younger, but especially when we got into high school and obviously you're getting recognition and these offers and it's very easy to look ahead.
Was there like anybody specific in your life, Cam, that influenced that, or was it like just like seeing like, you know, stuff on Instagram and TikTok that kind of like inspired that mindset, or it happened naturally?
It was definitely my high school coaches, like Hayden said, Andrew and George. We used to talk about it all the time. We still talk about it to this day. Just be where your feet are, be present. Don't look ahead, you know, just really enjoy where you are, because especially with college, you're only gonna be here one time, whether you're here 1 year, 2 year, three, four, now you're seeing 50 years, whatever. But just be where you are, you know, enjoy the moment, and max out where you are.
It's the right mindset to have in life for sure. No matter what stage you're at, you got to enjoy the here and now. So it's cool you guys have that. You guys are here with State Farm joining me here on my show. What are you guys doing with State Farm?
We have a national commercial coming out soon. We were able to meet with Jake from State Farm, just have a really nice shoot. And obviously, it was just an honor to be able to work with a brand like State Farm. Obviously, seeing the commercials with Chris Paul and Cooper Flagg, and just be able to be a part of that family now is just a real feeling.
Cool, guys. Appreciate you so much for joining me today. Yeah, good luck rest of the season. I look forward to watching you.
Yes, sir. Thank you. We appreciate it.
Thank you.